Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of dark energy. You've arrived at a nexus point, a crossroads of shadow and light, a phantasmagorical marketplace of ideas and blasphemies, a spicy melting pot of cultures and subcultures, from the benign to the bizarre, where we together prowl this wilderness of smoke and mirrors, all on the same path, searching for breadcrumbs of cosmic understanding, and hoping we'll be able to follow the trail back to where we started. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, and humble facilitator of an impending cacophony of conversation. I'm very pleased to be back with you again. I miss being here, and I get kind of amped up when it gets close to my turn to host the show. Feels like it's months since I've been here. First off, a hearty congratulations to Art and George and Ian, Tom and Lisa, all the folks at Coast to Coast. They just hit a milestone this month. I don't know if they mentioned it on the air, so I will. 525 radio stations carrying this program now. 525, and that is awesome. And, of course, you know, more listeners following us on Streamlink as well. We, of course, appreciate your loyalty to the show and your interest in the subjects that we tackle. 525, that's an amazing figure. A word or two about tonight's program. Ever since our earliest ancestors stumbled out of the trees or out of the cave, looked up at the sky, saw birds flying effortlessly through the heavens, we've been jealous. We look at them and we ask, why can't we do that? Even before we knew about gravity or had a name for it, we longed for the day when we'd conquer it and fly. Well, we can fly, at least we have contraptions that can fly, but have we, in fact, figured out gravity? What is it? How does it work? Have we conquered it? Or is that just still a dream? Our main guest tonight is a scientist and author who thinks that anti-gravity technology is not a dream or a goal. He says we already have it. We've been working on it largely in secret for the past several decades, and it might already be in use in aircraft that all of us have seen, only they're not telling us the full story. Coming up in hour two, I'll be joined by Dr. Paul LaViolette, author of a new book, Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion. And he'll sort of walk us through the little-known history of this ambitious, grand scientific undertaking, one that has largely been clouded in secrecy, supposedly for our own good. I think we're going to have a lot of fun with this. I finished reading his book this afternoon. It is jam-packed with jaw-dropping information. At least it was new to me. This weekend here in Las Vegas, the world's foremost psychic warriors gathered for the 10th annual IRVA convention. That's the International Remote Viewing Association. You know them. You love them. I had a chance to attend for a few hours on Friday, heard some of the presentations, interviewed some of the main players in the world of remote viewing. Our pal George Norrie was there on Saturday and, as always, was a big draw. I know George interviewed some of the participants in the IRVA conference last week leading up to the conference. Coming up in a couple of minutes, we'll get a recap of what happened and what new evidence may or may not have surfaced in the world of remote viewing from a longtime friend of this program, Colonel John Alexander, who lives here in Las Vegas as well, and in the eyes of some of you out there, is a pretty spooky guy. He certainly is an interesting guy and travels in interesting circles, and we'll catch up with him a couple of minutes from now. If you're like me, you probably stayed close to the television today, waiting to see what happens next in Iran. The Iranian people not ready to capitulate, not ready to behave and go to their rooms and be quiet. They're ticked. They're ticked off about a very suspicious election. And even after being admonished by their supreme religious leader, told to back down or else, they're out in the streets again today and tonight, risking death or imprisonment to express their outrage. And their despotic leaders are doing what despots always do. They respond with force. People are being beaten. They're being shot, tear gassed, clubbed, arrested. As of tonight, CNN just reported about an hour ago, more than two dozen journalists have been arrested. Others, foreign journalists, have been ordered to leave that country. The Iranian mullahs don't want the world to see what's going on over there. Who would ever imagine that these pain-in-the-butt, aggravating, sometimes narcissistic technologies, these social network tools like Facebook and Twitter and cell phone cameras would become such powerful weapons for a democratic movement? Cell phone footage, if you've been watching the news, that this stuff is slipping past the censors, the censors who control the state media over there in Iran. This stuff is getting out to the rest of the world, documenting the brutality. Who would ever think that Twitter would become such a vital tool in allowing Iranian protesters to communicate not only with each other, but with the world? But that's what's happening. I'm not much of a Twitter person. I'm not a Twitter person at all. But I've been getting emails all week in which Twitter users are urging each other to, and again, I don't understand the exact terminology, but to log in using Tehran as a home base, as your home base, in order to make it harder for the Iranian secret police to track down Iranian tweeters. And I think a lot of Americans are doing exactly that, sort of as a gesture of support for the Iranian people. And you know, it seems unthinkable now, but it wasn't that long ago that Americans and Iranians were friends. I mean, our governments didn't always get along, but they liked us. We liked them. And, you know, it could be that way again, if not for these hardline religious nutballs who've distorted their own religion for reasons of pure power and control. And now I think they're showing themselves for what they really are. And Iranians are learning that what they thought was a democracy is one in name only. I don't know how these Ayatollahs are going to put this genie back in the bottle or get this horse back in the barn. You know, maybe it's going to end bloody. I hope not. Maybe it'll take a long time to get the job done. But it sure looks like we're witnessing winds of change sweep over Persia. And maybe we can get into that with John Alexander for his take coming up in a couple of minutes when he joins us. A couple of intriguing stories posted on the Coast website tonight by our very capable webmaster, Tim Binall. One of the stories is about something going on here in my little neck of the woods. It's a Washington Post story about plans to build an ambitious, cutting-edge solar power facility, a solar farm, really, outside Las Vegas and on the edge of the sprawling Nellis Air Force Range. Now, this Nellis Range is vital to the Air Force. I think it represents something like 40% of the entire airspace devoted to the Air Force's control in this country. So it's vital to them. But this giant solar company from California has been jumping through all the hoops that the Pentagon has mentioned, trying to figure out how they can build this solar farm without hurting Nellis operations or interfering in any way. And it's moved the site at Nellis' suggestion, and now the Air Force has recommended, after all this trouble, it's recommended the plan be scrapped altogether, that the BLM turn them down because, and this is the interesting part in the story, because of something very secret that they're working on out there. Not the Predator, not these other UAV programs, since those are pretty well known. They've been on the news a lot of times. It's not the F-22. That's also well known. It's something else, something so highly classified that no one can even give a hint about what it might be. Anyway, the story's on the Coast website, so if you have any guesses what this project might be after you read this piece, let me know because it's driving me crazy. There's another story. It's not on the website, but I think Tim's going to send it out as a Twitter feed. There's that word again, Twitter. I'm going to have to get up to speed on that, I guess. It's something that was sent to me and a lot of other people during the past week. It's about the big switch from analog to digital television. This article is just a tad on the sensational side. It argues that the whole switch to digital HDTV is really a CIA mind control plot. The thesis is that this HDTV technology will allow the government to control your thoughts and emotions and actions. They could use their secret frequencies and CRISPR images to force us to all do their bidding, such as, I don't know, make us go to the fridge to get a frozen pizza. Seriously, the article says it paves the way that they can make us do whatever they want us to do, which, of course, is what advertisers have been hoping for since the beginning of time, and maybe the government, too. I don't believe this story. I don't believe it for a second, but I love a good conspiracy yarn, so, you know, we're putting it out there, and check it out when Tim sends it your way. My favorite news item of the past few weeks is one that is getting almost no coverage from mainstream media. Big surprise there. But, man, it's a weird one. And maybe you've read about it online. It's about a bust that was made by Italian police at their border with Switzerland. Two Japanese nationals tried to enter Italy with an odd stash of contraband. Hidden inside their suitcases were bearer bonds, a total of like 259 bonds, U.S. Federal Reserve bonds worth, get this, $134 billion. $134 billion. I mean, wow. The U.S. government has said that, oh, these got to be obvious fakes, but maybe not. Turns out, we learned today, these two Japanese nationals work for Japan's finance ministry. The Japanese are holding something like $600 billion in U.S. bonds, and some suspect that they're worried America is no longer good for the money. We might not ever be able to honor these bonds. So maybe the Japanese were looking to dump them somewhere on somebody else. Or maybe it's true that they're complete fakes, but, you know, then why are these guys who work for their government smuggling them in the bottom of a suitcase on the border of two European countries? I love this story. I'm amazed none of the networks have done anything with it. Then again, maybe I'm not amazed. Anyway, we've got the latest info in this mystery, maybe some pictures, I think, of the $134 billion worth of bonds. And you can read that stuff for yourself. Well, let's take our first break now. When we come back, we'll be joined by the ever-mysterious Colonel John Alexander. Stick around. We're just getting started here on the one and only Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. My name is George Knapp. So glad you could be with us here tonight. We'll be bringing Colonel John Alexander on in just a second. I want to mention one other thing before we get to him. You remember these guys, the Time Monks that we had on last year, Cliff and George? I had them on the program last year, and I think they've been on with George Norrie as well. Very interesting guys. They've been sending me some interesting emails in the past couple of weeks. You know, these are the guys who have this ongoing research program where they attempt to read the future by analyzing massive amounts of information on the Internet. And they told me that my name came up in the course of their research, and it came up in the context of this program. They seem to think that something I'm going to say on this program, maybe tonight, or maybe next Sunday night, is going to trigger a reaction in, for lack of a better term, a deep throat source out there. Someone who is looking to spill the beans about government knowledge of UFOs and other strange stuff, insider stuff. The person I'm talking about is an insider himself or herself and has been thinking about coming forward. And something I'm going to say or something that he hears on this program tonight or next Sunday is going to get him to do it. And I don't know what it is. All I know is the Time Monks are taking this pretty seriously. They told me about it. It sounded like an interesting experiment to see if we could sort of create a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that's kind of why I'm mentioning it, to see what happens. There are other aspects to this that they've told me about that they're predicting that are a little bit spooky. Things they're predicting that would make for some bumpy road ahead, adventure, if you will. I would say that if there really is a deep throat guy out there who is considering whether to make contact, I urge caution. Maybe I'm paranoid and been around conspiracy stuff too much, but I'd think twice about what method I use to communicate with something like this. I mean, I suspect there are massive email mining operations. A lot of what we write online or say on cell phones is scooped up and put into computer files somewhere. I'd keep that in mind. And hey, if it works out as the Time Monks have predicted, I hope one day I can let you all know about it, assuming that's what the deep throat guy wants to do. And we got to get those Time Monk guys back on here. They're interesting guests. Going now to our first guest tonight, Colonel John Alexander, Dr. John Alexander. He's one of the world's foremost experts in the development of non-lethal weapons. He's written a couple of books, including Future War and Winning the War, and is deeply involved in the remote viewing, the IRVA Association, that held its 10th annual conference here this weekend in Las Vegas. John, you there?
We are, and I guess you can be ever mysterious then, too.
you tell me the truth, though. You revel in that, don't you, being a spooky kind of a guy?
I'm not spooky, but, it's whatever. I hear it all the time.
Well, I mean, you travel to UFO conferences, other kind of conferences, and you sometimes are known to dump cold water on conspiracy theories and that sort. And, you hear the scuttlebutt at these gatherings that, that's John Alexander. He's one of those guys. He's one of the insiders.
Well, in fact, one of your lead-ins I found most interesting, the talking about mind control and all of that. I was a couple of months ago in Germany and was picketed, and it was by Christians against mental slavery. So it was directly in line with that. And what I pointed out to them was, if we had this capability, don't you think, like, the elections would have been different, or we wouldn't have all the problems going on? Ahmadinejad would have been gone peacefully. I mean, there's just a host of things that argue against it. But
I agree with you. It's just a fun conspiracy, one I hadn't heard before. But you were personally picketed.
Oh, yes. It's happened several times. And they're friendly folks. I mean, you can talk to them, and never had them get violent or anything, but, you know, the logic just failed. In fact, I pointed out that the first known mind control device was actually known as the heirloom and came out in 1812. Long before we had the electrical grid to do these things with.
John, I want to talk to you about remote viewing, of course, and the conference that was held this weekend. But I do want to get into the Iran thing. It's hard to ignore that story today. I know you travel a lot. You are an advisor to a variety of military-related organizations. I'd like to get your take on this thing. Well, for,
very,
first of
very,
all, how dangerous it is?
Yeah, very, very serious. And I have argued, and this, some of this goes back to the actions of the Bush administration, which I thought were wrong, in that they were, you know, very vehemently anti-Iranian, and you heard this hue and cry, when in fact the Iranians themselves were very, very split. Many of them were quite pro-American, you know, as you pointed out in the warm-up there. I remember being in Dubai and going out on a safari and ending up with some Iranians there and talking to them. And they say, oh, yes, we used to live in Dallas. You know,
huh.
So they're, you know, the country or the people of the country are really quite positive, living under some rather austere and strict conditions. But being vehemently anti-Iranian, if you try to force them into a box, you know, they're going to support their country just like most Americans would.
So you would suggest that, overtly anyway, the American government should keep its hands off this thing?
Well, I think we have to. And our reputation in the area is not that great. We've had problems, you know, before. And we'll be seen as meddling. Remember, we did assist in, you know, supporting the Shah, and so that there's some history there that does not bode well.
Tell me this. Do you think that the Ayatollahs can put the genie back in the bottle, that they can, you know, keep a lid on this thing, make everybody behave?
Well, my concern is that you're looking at a potentially another Tiananmen Square. The answer is yes, they can. Will they? Hard to say. How long does that last? You know, I think you can do these things temporarily, but not for, you know, not over a long duration, I don't think.
And I know you have a lot of interesting sources, government sources, military sources. Do you have any insight into the legitimacy of the election?
No more than you do. I don't know that anybody has that one, except, you know, it's highly suspicious when you look at, you know, the percentage of votes that Ahmadinejad was claiming to have just seems to run against everything that was predicted or has been seen since.
The point we were making about technology and this social networking stuff actually becoming a factor in what's going on over there, I know you've written about technology and things of that sort. Has that ever played into any of the scenarios that you envisioned?
Yes, but that's more than, you know, the next hour conversation.
Oh, okay. All right.
It really is terribly complex. And part of the problem is, in this case, you're getting information coming out. It's the only information. Now, the downside is that you get a lot of crap. You know, the GIGO problem, garbage in, garbage out. And in this system, there are no filters. There is no way to self-correct, and that's always dangerous.
Let's shift gears to remote viewing. How'd the conference end up? Success?
Very much, very much. And we'd like to thank you and the other George. You know, George Nuri was here, and certainly their support was helpful. And locally, you know, Joe Shonan wrote an article in The Sun that was helpful in picking up a lot of people from the Las Vegas area. But the speakers were good, had an experiment today that went well, and yeah, overall quite a success. I suspect we'll be doing it again next year.
I just, has remote viewing peaked? I mean, you know, the story's out there. It's been around for a while. Is it, does it show signs that it's spreading through through society at large, or is it going to be as big as it's going to get?
Well, first of all, I think it's a misnomer. And like remote viewing sort of became a thing. It became associated with, you know, in the public's mind with the Stargate program and some of those things. The reality is that people have been doing this as long as there are people. I thought when you first initiated and talking about the advent of man, I mean, men were highly intuitive and had developed these senses for survival. You know, how do you find food and water and things of that nature? And much of those natural intuitions were suppressed over time. So everybody does it. Ups and downs, I mean, the social issues, that's kind of hard to say. But certainly there's a lot of people out there practicing now.
Well, we're going to get into more of your experiment that was conducted there at the IRVA convention when we come back after this break. The WHO taking us into the break. Stay with us. More of our conversation with Colonel John Alexander. My name is George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. Good evening, everyone. Thanks for being with us. We've just started our conversation with Colonel John Alexander. In addition to commanding special forces teams in Vietnam and Thailand back in the day and being a consultant to NATO and other organizations, John, during his time as a colonel in Army Intelligence, was involved in the program we now know as remote viewing as it was being developed and perfected by the Army. And he told me something this weekend I'd never heard about before, and it was about a counterintelligence operation involving remote viewers aimed at Area 51. Area 51 was the target of these remote viewers. And as they focused their consciousness on that secret base, guess what they found? When we come back, we'll have the answer to that. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, everyone. That was a recording or something. I don't know what just happened there, but we lost our connection for some reason. And anyway, we're going to go back now to talk to John Alexander, and in a moment we'll be opening up the phone line so you can ask him some questions as well. John, I was amazed to hear this story that you told me about the counter-intel operation involving Area 51. Tell the story.
Okay. Well, I, too, was surprised at that lead-in, having since you mentioned this one in particular. Well, basically what happened was, this is, as you said, back in the day. This was before the F-117 or what's known as the stealth fighter had been made public. And the reality is this was very, very secret, a very tightly held secret even within the military. And so, and they had spent quite a bit of money in what we call counterintelligence, you know, protecting the program from access to, for the enemy to, in that case, the Soviet Union, to find it. So somebody who had heard about the remote viewing program said, gee, I wonder what they can do. So we had this group of guys at Fort Meade, Maryland, who had never heard of Have Blue, which was the earlier name, or any of the programs for the initial stealth aircraft, became the F-117. So they were targeted against it, and damned if they didn't draw something. They got an aircraft. They weren't told where it was, though the coordinates were out near Groom Lake, and they found the underground bunkers and found the aircraft and do it quite accurately. And now that was only part of the surprise. The real surprise came when they picked up on a second project. And this was not one that the people were planning to have disclosed. And basically what it appears is not only did they find the F-117, which was fairly advanced and was flying and was used in Panama openly for the first time several months later, but they picked out on the follow-on program as well.
Meaning the B-2.
But if we think it's the one that became the B-2.
Wow. So I
that
can imagine.
Scared everybody. You can imagine. They said that was their response. Wow.
The guys at Area
51. How do we protect this?
And the answer is?
With great difficulty.
Meaning you can't. As far as you know, there is no protection.
Right. And pretty much that is the case.
Well, you know what the question would be then. If something is that valuable, that has that much potential significance, why would the government cancel it? And as you know, a lot of people believe the government didn't cancel it. They just put it further in the black.
Are we referring to the 117?
No. I'm talking about remote viewing.
Oh, the remote viewing program. That's a question that comes up. The reality is you ran into a zero-sum game. By 1995, money was getting very, very tight. There were also internal battles going on, interagency turf battles. And the decision had been made to move the program from DIA back to CIA. And Bob Gates, the now Secretary of Defense, was the DCI and did not want the program, but because of political pressure, just couldn't turn it down. So what they did was have an independent study. And the results of that were not ready for prime time. Now, why do I think that it's not ongoing internally? Because the talent pool of trusted agents was really very small. And everybody knows everybody. In fact, many of them were, you know, here this weekend. Now, that said, that does not mean that there aren't individual requests. You know, people call one of the remote viewers. In fact, I heard of a program today where they were looking for some folks in Iraq who had been captured and want to know what happened to them. But this is, you know, an individual in the Pentagon or another agency contacting an individual, one of the remote viewers as a friend and saying, you know, can you help me out? And that's very, very different from what was going on, you know, back in the 80s and early 90s.
Tell me this. Tell me about the experiment that was conducted. I know there was a tweeter experiment or something like that that was discussed.
Well, the Twitter experiment was really terrible, just not very good. It was run by a skeptic. There's a host of technical problems, including the mathematical models that were used and that. In fact, one of the things that George Nuri announced, and I was at a board of directors meeting tonight, and we're going to go ahead and try to design a study that, you know, gets around the obstacles that were done in the poor one that, unfortunately, the press picked up and gave it a lot of play.
That makes it look like the overall technique itself
doesn't work.
And well, what was the experiment?
It was terribly flawed, and especially mathematically.
What experiment did you conduct that was more successful this weekend? Tell me about that.
Oh, this weekend was just one that we do every time. We call an outbound viewer, and a target somebody is sent out. In this case, it was Paul Smith, who, you know, has been on the program, the president of IRVA. And then a target was selected, and he went there with a few people and observed and took a video camera with him and then came back. In the meantime, the people who were at the conference had all tried their hand. Now, many of them, I would say the majority of the people, have had at least some remote viewing training. And the result was that about 50% of the people came up with some very accurate descriptions of the site. The site happened to have been a lake park down in Henderson, not far from where we were meeting.
Well, it's, as you and I have discussed before, you think that everyone has some degree of talent in this area, but some people are superstars and that they can be trained to become megastars.
I believe that is the case. And we also asked, well, if it's so good, you know, one of the questions is, why aren't you rich? And I like Uri Geller's response to that. Says, people say, if you're so psychic, why aren't you rich? He just says, I am. But it's actually a lot tougher. I mean, it's you really got to put a lot of work into it. And it's just like any other skill, be it running or basketball or tennis, you got to practice.
And do you do it? I mean, you had training in it long ago.
I've had some modicum of training, but I am more the scientist, observer, and facilitator.
We got some folks on the lines waiting to talk to you. Wildcard line, Mark in Oregon. Hi, Mark. Mark, you there? I am not
Hello?
Hearing.
Are you
hey,
can hear
Mark,
me now?
How you doing? Yeah, we can. What's on your mind?
I heard the noise, and I knew I was in. Good evening to you, George and Colonel Alexander.
Hi.
Earlier on, George, before the Colonel came on the show, you were speaking of the complete switch over from any remaining analog signal to television sets in this country to the digital format. And I believe you speculated or wondered, perhaps, could there be something to do with what we've heard of, and there is a great body of research to support this, that actually through television, not just in this country, but in other locations and countries in the world, that there is actually subliminal messaging going on relative to the frequency rate of the receiver signal of the television set as it's broadcast through the visual image electromagnetically being matched to the frequency rate of the human brain. And that this has been going on in one form or another through celluloid starting back in the 50s all the way up to the present, and it's been converted into a video format, and it's not only on television but in movies. And
so are you saying that the premise of the article that we talked about, though, Mark, was that the reason for the digital switch was mind control? Is that your premise?
Exactly. And it's really not a premise, George and Carnal, because there is a great body of evidence and research where it supports this. So it's beyond a premise and it's beyond a theory. It's actually proven scientific fact.
Well, let's get John's take on it. John, you've written about future technology, and what do you think?
Yeah, beware of unintended consequences. Can you do some things? Well, probably subliminal perception has been around for decades. Contrary to popular belief, there are no laws against it. If you look at ads, I mean, I look at some Victoria Gets Women's magazines, and I look at some of those and go, like, what is that ad for? It does makes no sense. And yet it's for the purse, that's sitting there on the floor. And they say women see that sort of thing. So the point is that people pick up on various sorts of things, and this has been going on, as long as we've been advertising. But if you're going to say that now we're going to have some program that's going to transfer the people into automatons or something, then I got some real problem.
Okay. Mark, I appreciate the call, and you sound like you got some info behind that. I'm going to have to actually take another look at this stuff and give it some more thought. Wildcard line, Tim in Wisconsin. Hi, Tim. How you doing?
Good, George. Good evening, gentlemen. George, I just have to say, long-time listener, wish you were on a little more often. But I have to say, ask the Colonel, good evening. I've kind of got a little theory. I don't know if I'd call it conspiracy, but wonder what you guys' thoughts are on the Iranian situation right now. And wondering if you might think, like I'm kind of viewing, do you think possibly are the red nations, meaning Russia, China, North Korea, possibly meeting behind closed doors, although there's supposed to be a democratic regime and politicos happening in Iran right now? Could it possibly be, because there's a lot of buzzword phraseology of Tiananmen Square, could we be watching another communist state being created right in front of us? And is this a play on the West?
I'd say there's two chances, incredibly slim and none. This is a theocracy that we're dealing with, and you don't find theocracies and communism very compatible. And if you obviously haven't been to China, you hear the red things. I've been in China. What's going on there is absolutely amazing. They're not going to put that genie back in the bottle. They have a controlled economy, but the entrepreneurship has taken over. George, that's worth a whole 3 hours sometime.
Sure.
What's going on? I mean, I've argued that the notion that we're going to fight China anytime is specious. That said, we are in direct conflict, but it's economic. But the only thing that they're communist, is like when I was in Vietnam, the only thing communist about that is the little red flags that fly.
Well, thanks for the call, Tim, but it sort of was going into what I was wondering earlier. You mentioned that China, you can't put that genie back in the bottle, but Iran, you think it can?
Well, I think they can suppress for a while. But remember, they've got very, very good control at this point. whether it will remain in the bottle. Remember, you had Tiananmen Square. They did put it back in the bottle for a while, and you go there now, and it's a very, very different country. Do they control society more than here? Absolutely. But is it, you know, Mao's not a good guy anymore, and you can say virtually anything you want, except maybe free Tibet. They don't like that one very much. But,
and now with Falun Gong. Okay, well, back to the phones. Toxic Reverend on the West of the Rockies line, the Toxic Reverend in Santa Rosa, sends us a lot of emails here at Coast to Coast. How you doing?
Good, George. Thank you.
Sure.
I guess after the last one that called in about the, well, let's just say anything that I'm going to say to, I'll just refer to Professor Nicholson's work with this work on infectious incapacitating agents. Now, the infectious ones, like the mycoplasmas, are dramatically different than other incapacitating tools such as tasers, which we now have hundreds of people dying in America from being tasered.
Nobody has died from taser any place in the world. Let's put that one to bed.
Well, actually, there's some pretty good reports on that where they've been documenting quite a bit. So
it absolutely is not. And I'll give
right.
you the...
Well, we'll just pass that one by, and I'll go with the infectious agents, with the mycoplasmas.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Mycoplasma infections, they're incapacitating agents. I thought you were an expert on incapacitating agents.
Non-lethal weapons.
Exactly. It's a non-lethal weapon.
I am, and I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, you can simply Google mycoplasmas and incapacitating agents.
Why don't you tell us what it is?
Well, they're highly associated now with asthma, arthritis, several dozen chronic illnesses. Seems to be what the Gulf War vets are mainly ill with. You have no comment on that yet? You're an expert?
Well, hey, there's no reason to be nasty about it. I think he was trying to figure out what the context of the question was, and so was I, frankly. So are you asking him, does he think that these could be used as weapons or are being used as weapons? Or,
well, they are. They have been. The Gulf War vets are ill with them. Go to GulfWarVets.com. You'll find plenty of information on that.
Yeah, but that does not make weapons or what we make. I happen to be in favor of area incapacitating weapons. And I think that what's evolving, the threats that are evolving both internally and externally, are going to require those. I also know that, interestingly, the agencies who most vehemently rate those messages you meant about Taser are equally against any incapacitating agents. I think we're going to have to, if you look at Mumbai, what happened there, and I agree, if you look at the terrorist attacks that have happened in the last few years, major switches, these people did not come to negotiate, they came to die. And they came to die in a, you know, spectacular manner, take as many people with them as they can. Therefore, I think what we need is the ability to, you know, put everybody down and sort the good guys and the bad guys.
Hey, Toxic
Reverend. Controversial, but...
Okay. Toxic Reverend, thanks for that call. John, thanks for being here. I wish we had more time to talk about remote viewing, but I'm certain we can have you back again. John Alexander, author of Future War and Winning the War. Check those books out if you want to learn more about non-lethal weapons. And when we come back... we'll be joined by Dr. Paul LaViolette to talk about secrets of anti-gravity propulsion. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM.